Hey, everyone. It's Naomi Wolf with Daily Cloud, and I'm so absolutely thrilled to be welcoming Daniel G. Newman. Daniel, welcome to this conversation.
Thank you, Naomi. Pleasure to be here.
And the reason I'm sort of overflowing with joy is that Daniel is one of my like last remaining personal heroes. He's been my hero for years now, ever since I first met him through his work on MapLight. And he is a national expert on government, accountability, and money in politics. I met him when he still is, president and co-founder of MapLight, which is a fantastic nonprofit that promotes transparency and political reform. And it's been a model of the kinds of things you could do with digital access to empower people in the democratic process. So he was an inspirer of Daily Clout. He's inspired me. He's inspired people across the country. MapLight has earned a Knight Batten Award for innovations in journalism, a James Madison Freedom of Information Award, a Library Journal Best Reference Award. That's huge. And a Webby. So it's like the trifecta for, you know, democracy nerds. You know, it's like those people who win, you know, the Emmy and the Oscar and the BAMMY or whatever the music one is. And he was listed in Fast Company's 100 Most Creative People in Business. So as a democracy nerd myself, this, you know, has been an absolute inspiration to me and to all of us at Daily Cloud. So welcome. And now, what I'm also thrilled about is that we're here to talk about Unrig, which has just come out July 7th, one of the most important books, and I don't say this lightly, I've ever read. And it's one of the most important books you'll ever read. And you especially have to read it in the next 2 or 3 weeks, certainly before November. It's the subtitle is How to Fix Our Broken Democracy. And it's not just by Daniel Newman. It's also an illustrated comic book illustrated by distinguished illustrator George O'Connor, who is a New York Times bestselling author and illustrator of the Olympians series and other graphic novels. And this is so important because we'll get into it in a minute, but Daniel and George basically tell the story in comic book format of how democracy got broken in America and what we could do to fix it. So before we launch right in, let's start with the obvious. Why a comic book, Daniel?
So, Naomi, I think there's this misconception that the problems of democracy are just too complicated. And I think that there are forces that try and keep people from paying attention. And you have these names which are kind of boring, like voter registration and redistricting and campaign finance. But those names are actually about these rules that govern how government works, who does Congress and the state legislatures pay attention to, and ultimately, whose interests do laws serve. And so I thought by writing a comic book, it would really open this up to so many people that anyone from adults all the way down to young people could really understand the rules of our government that have been rigged in favor of wealth and what needs to happen to unrig them.
Absolutely. And what's so wonderful to me, you know, immersed in this stuff week by week, is that by choosing a graphic novel storytelling style and following individuals, you and your illustrator, George O'Connor, really do make these incredibly head-splittingly difficult issues incredibly super clear. And I also remember when I first met you, you said something so formative to me. I've never forgotten it. You said they make it boring on purpose. And that just it was one of those aha moments. And it kind of has motivated me to, when someone's throwing verbiage to try to create smoke and mirrors to disempower the people, I think of you, I think of MapLight, and I soldier on, because you're right. It's not boring because we're stupid. It's boring because they're trying to make it boring. So one of the things you do in this amazing book is you actually tell the story of Paul Perry, a guy who ran for Congress. Tell us why you chose him and what his story illustrates.
So I think that people understand anything best by learning about individual people going through it. And Paul is a real person. He's a candidate. He was a candidate for Congress from Philadelphia. And he was, he still is a great guy, a real community grassroots leader. And he ran for office and just like right out of the gate, got killed by his opponents raising so much more money. So he's a grassroots leader, and the people running against him are, they're married to a millionaire. The other one is a lobbyist tapped into DC money. And so Paul very quickly is outspent and he drops out of the race. And I put this in there to show that these forces we have of money-dominated politics is, they do affect people, and they sort of show what the alternative is and we're missing. And then the other reason I put it in there, Naomi, is to pair it with how things could be. And the great thing about this book is that I'm able to put forward solutions and stories where actually these problems are solved. And in the news, we read mostly about problems, but in this book, we talk about problems, but really also talk about the solutions and how they came about. And in it, this very next story after Paul is the story of Teresa Mosqueda, who was another grassroots candidate. She ran for Seattle City Council, and she won with a program called Democracy Vouchers in Seattle. Democracy Vouchers is, the city of Seattle gives $100 in coupons to every person in Seattle, and they can spend it on political campaigns. So that means, yeah, so if you're a grassroots candidate, you can run for office and win without having to be tapped into lobbyists, without being wealthy yourself. You can go door to door, get these democracy vouchers, and get elected and represent the people.
Incredible. Can I just jump in and ask,
yeah,
do the democracy vouchers, are they accepted by like TV stations where you want to run ads and political consultants? Like, what do they actually pay for?
Yeah, so they go right to the candidate, and the candidate trades them into the city for money. So,
oh my goodness, real money? Wow.
It's real money, yeah. So the candidates, like for example, Teresa raised $300,000 in these vouchers. He maxed out on the system, got that much money, and she could spend it on mailers, TV ads, campaign consultants. Now, other candidates, like who aren't running under democracy vouchers in the old money-dominated system, they might raise about the same amount of money. They spend it on the same things. But the difference is when Teresa gets elected, she doesn't have any big money favors to pay back. And so she can represent the people.
Extraordinary. And is, of all the different solutions you've seen, is this one of your favorites?
It is one of my favorites. You know, another place in the book, I talk about Charles Koch, who's an infamous billionaire, who's part of this network to really stop government from functioning and make government only responsive to the very wealthy people. So he spends about $18 million in this dark money secret network, people like him, trying to keep Merrick Garland, Obama's Supreme Court nominee, off the bench and succeeding in that. Now, this $18 million sounds like a lot of money, but to the average person in the U.S., the wealth of the average person in the U.S., it's like $36 to an average person, is $18 million to Charles Koch. So you have this situation where, like, the people who are the wealthiest in our society and those people who are trying to bias government toward the wealthy, like, they have unlimited financial resources. And so what we have to do together is to really stop money from dominating who can get elected. And that's why democracy vouchers and other public funding of elections are the linchpin of this.
Absolutely. Tell me along those lines about how you see the role of SCAFE money and how Unrig explains the role of SCAFE money.
Yeah, so there's, right, the Charles Koch and SCAFE and Betsy DeVos, current Secretary of Education, her family. So they're all in this, these allied billionaires who have the same particular view that, like, everybody's out for themselves. I already got my money. I don't want to pay taxes to support anyone else. I don't want government really to do much of anything. And so they've funded, for example, moving legal education to the right, funding what was originally a fringe program called Law and Economics, and making it mainstream by giving money to Harvard and Yale and Columbia and many other law schools to teach that the law should be based on economics instead of other values. And over a long period of time, this has had an effect. And one of the things I do in my book is really unpack this 50-year campaign to move all the institutions of society to, not just to the right, the right doesn't really capture it. It's really about representing only the wealthy.
Absolutely. And what I love about Unrig is the way that you've taken a lot of stories that are, some of them are familiar to us. Like, I see, you know, some of the story of dark money, some of, you know, a lot of exposés of money and politics work that you've done, but you do something I've never seen anyone do before, which is you put it in the broadest possible context. And then again, you follow these individuals and show how it literally creates roadblocks where good people just can't get elected. And if they do get elected, as you say, it's with so many obligations, so many checks that have already been cashed that they have to repay. And that's really, you know, it's an extraordinary achievement. And I have to say, other books I read about this, you know, you end up wanting to just kill yourself. I mean, it's so depressing. But you're, you know, as you foreshadowed, you have so many practical solutions, and you've seen so many ways democracy works and doesn't. And I love how you highlight things like, you know, democracy vouchers. And I was going to also ask you about the pro rep system and, you know, other solutions at the end of the book. But before we get there, I just want to ask you what you see as the relationship between reforming the voting system and its relationship to racial justice.
Yes, well, so we have this wonderful moment in our society here where racial justice is getting heightened attention. And I want to point out that the movements for racial justice led by Black Americans have been essential to improving U.S. democracy for everyone, right? And that's so why it's so important to support, like, the Black Lives Matter, the current movement for racial justice, because it's a continuation of, for example, the civil rights movements, which came to prominence in 1950s and 60s. One of the great victories of that movement was expanding voting rights, not just for Black people, but for everyone, right? So there's this way that that these movements improve the country for us all. I also want to point out specifically on the issue of police violence, mm-hmm. that one of the key contributing factors to that is the lack of accountability for police who are violent. And often it's the district attorneys, often an elected position, who make the decision on whether to prosecute or not police officers for misconduct. Now, because of our broken money in politics system, we make those district attorneys dependent on special interest money, including money from police officers' unions. And so all over the country, you have district attorneys elected, reliant on police officer money to get elected. And of course, they're not going to represent the greater public interest as well if they are dependent on police union money. And so that's one of the many ways in which how we finance our elections ties directly to another problem in society.
I'm really glad you brought up these connections, because people can often think, you know, voting rights, it's so abstract, or it only affects me once every 4 years, or people get it that it goes to, you know, Supreme Court decisions. But you really drill down with examples like that throughout the book, I would say, and show how cleaning up the system in the ways that you've described helps us day by day live more safely, more equitably. I just want to say, as a former New York City woman, I really had a very painful kind of eyewitness experience of what you're talking about, because Cy Vance wouldn't arrest Harvey Weinstein after woman after woman after woman came forward and accused him of very violent, serious sexual abuses. And there's no question that money was a factor in that perpetrator being multiply named, or alleged perpetrator, until he was convicted in New York City. And the experience of being a woman walking the streets of New York City, knowing that that law enforcement at the top level was not arresting a named alleged perpetrator of such a scale, was really chilling. And then, you know, the kinds of activism that you described would clean up situations like that, I think, considerably. And again, it's not partisan. Like, I know that you talk about the money coming from the right, but it does seem like the solutions that you propose really are nonpartisan. So let's go now to some of your solutions. You don't like the Electoral College. Talk about that.
So a lot of people in the country think that you vote for president and you elect the president. But it's actually a lot more complicated and a lot worse, really, than that. So when you cast your vote, you're voting for a slate of what's called electors. Those are people in your state that go and vote for your favorite candidate. Now, the result of this is that a lot of votes in the country really don't matter for president. Like, if you're in a state that always votes Democratic, and if you're a Republican, then your votes really don't have an effect on the presidential election, which is fundamentally undemocratic. And so there's this great movement to elect the president by popular vote. It's called National Popular Vote. And it's a series of states that pass these laws that all agree together that they're going to award all their electoral votes to the winner of the popular vote nationally. And so this is explained more in comics. It's easier to understand that way. And the point of it is like, you can do what Sylvia Bernstein, an activist I described in my book, did. in her state, Colorado, got together 35 committed people, and they successfully lobbied the Colorado legislature to pass this law. And you can do that in your state as well.
Extraordinary. So it doesn't do away with the Electoral College so much as make it function differently so it can't be a roadblock to the popular vote. Am I understanding that correctly?
That's exactly right. So the Electoral College still exists, but functionally, the president will be elected by whoever gets the popular vote nationwide.
Wow. And how would that solve problems in your view? Like, why don't you like the Electoral College?
Well, the legitimacy of our democracy really rests on this idea that the majority rules. But yet, Donald Trump got elected with 60 million votes, while Hillary Clinton got 63 million votes. George W. Bush was elected, Bush versus Gore. Of course, Gore got more popular votes. You know, the system has come close to undemocratic results that also benefit Republicans. This is not a bipartisan thing. If candidate John Kerry had gotten a few more votes in Ohio, he would have become president, even though he had fewer popular votes. So the idea is that, like, we live in this country, we're taught from a young age, we live in a democracy, majority rules, but the system actually keeps breaking down. I mean, would you drive a car where, you know, 20% of the time it blew up? Like, of course not. But we have an election system where, like, lately 20% of the time it's not giving the correct result, and we have to fix that.
Understood. I mean, I guess people on the other side would say, playing devil's advocate, that we don't live in a democracy, we live in a constitutional republic, and that the founders set up our system to work this way in their foresight, you know, as a republic, and therefore tampering with something like the Electoral College is unpatriotic. What would you say to that?
Well, so over time in the country, like, you know, at the time of the U.S. Constitution in the late 1700s, only 6% of the country could vote.
Right.
6%. And yeah. Over time, we have a movement through organizing, through, pushing back in the face of violence against, like, votes for women, votes for African Americans, expanding the vote. And we have succeeded and continue to push on making the vote larger, you know, more people can participate. The Electoral College is kind of a similar thing. Like, back then, it's like, we don't want to give too much power to the people. You know, back in the day, like back in that era, U.S. senators were appointed by the state legislatures. But now every state has their senators elected by direct vote of the people, because that's, you know, that is giving power to the people. And so, like, these boundaries of who government represents in the U.S. have been constantly changing over time. And right. There's always been a force of sort of the wealthy versus what most of the people want.
Can I ask one super nerdy follow-up question?
Please.
I love talking to you because you're one of the few people I know who, you know, drills as deeply as you can drill into these things. And I know your eyes won't glaze over when I ask the questions like this. Wasn't the Electoral College rationalized because smaller states or less popular states didn't want to get rolled over by the big states?
Well, there was a lot of, there's so much that went into the Constitution that was a compromise among all different dimensions. I mean, one really major thread was about slavery. And so the infamous three-fifths compromise. So what that means is states where enslaved people lived, they would count those enslaved people as three-fifths of a person, not for voting. Those people, the enslaved people, didn't get to vote, but it gave more political power, more electoral votes, more seats in Congress. And so this is a way that the southern states, the states that owned, that enslaved people, actually got more political power. And so once you pat the Electoral College was passed, so that the southern states actually would breed enslaved people and increase the number of enslaved people in their states. And that gave them more political power. So the whole thing, like, it had a lot of threads to it, and it was part of a lot of compromises, but the slavery was a real central one.
Wow. Okay. So you're basically saying, I don't want to put words in your mouth, that there really is nothing sacred about the Electoral College.
Not at all. Not at all.
Gotcha. But again, forgive my ignorance, to really change the way the Electoral College works, don't we need a constitutional convention?
So amending the Constitution through a convention or an amendment passed by the states, like, either of those is possible. I think what I described earlier is this national popular vote, it's an agreement among states, is a lot more practical, because the fact is, it's just extremely difficult to pass any constitutional amendment.
Right. Is there a worry that a movement like that could bypass our checks and balances in our democratic system and just kind of rewrite the rules? I mean, we might like the outcome, but once you open the door to rewriting the rules, couldn't there be anarchy? Again, I'm just asking.
I think that's an argument against a constitutional convention where every rewriting the Constitution is on the table. The National Popular Vote Interstate Agreement is a series of state laws that are democratically elected in each state. So there's no big like barn door that gets open. It simply makes the presidential election work the way most people think it should, which is that whoever gets the most votes gets to be president.
And you would know, what's the data on how many people support abolishing the Electoral College or creating a popular voting system?
Yeah, you know, I don't know that offhand, but it's something that has very broad support. And I think, you know, in the last few elections, it's been the Republicans that have benefited from the current system, but it's not so far-fetched that there would be a Democrat elected who didn't get the popular vote either. And I think, like, if that does ever happen, then you'd see, like, very rapidly, like, all spectrums of the political equation uniting around changing this broken system.
Wow. All right. My God. This is so eye-opening. Okay. Are there other movements that you love that, you know, part of your solution section at the end, which I like so much there? You say join a group. Can you speak to that?
Yeah. So one of the things, there's a lot of books, as you mentioned, about democracy, where it's like, let's talk about how bad things are. And there's not that much about the solution or how you can get involved. And for my book, it's really woven throughout. And you know, you can be, you know, I have college students in the book. I have grandmothers in the book, like all about who are making change. And one of the things that I have a real practical section at the end is like, what can you do to get involved? And, you know, unrigging democracy, as I write, is not something that you do by yourself. It's something we do with other people. And you get together with people who are already doing this. So on my website, unrigbook.com, I have as a resource, you look up your state, you can find groups in your state or in your city that are working on this. Wow. There's a lot of people, Naomi, you know, there's a recent study that came out about a lot of people say that they're active politically, like a huge number of people. But when you get down to it, 80% of those people are actually like posting things on social media and complaining about to their friends. And it's only maybe 20 of those people that are actually doing things that will make a difference, which is joining with other people, joining with existing groups to push on legislation in your city, in your state, on federally, or get the candidates you want elected. And so that's...
You don't know how to, which is why you started your site and which is why we started ours, right? To make it easier.
Exactly. It's like access points, right? So it's just like with Daily Cloud, it's an access point to learn how to change things. Like Unrig as a comic book is an access point. And that's a central message. You know, I passed publicly funded elections in my city in Berkeley, California. And I did this starting out, never having run a campaign before. This is almost 20 years ago, with a democracy buddy, you know, just another person that I met that wanted to do the same thing. And the two of us was all it took. And then we got more people involved and more people. And all these things start like that.
So you, this, talk about bearing the lead, Daniel. 20 years ago, you passed publicly funded elections in Berkeley, California?
Well, the interesting thing is almost 20 years ago, back in 2004, I tried and failed and got a measure on the ballot. And I was crushed about this. The story is in the book. And I was like, oh my gosh, I put so much work into this and it failed. And I realized that these things take a while and that you try and you fail, but that sets you thing up for success. And then in 2016, we got it back on the ballot and we passed it. And so now it's in the city constitution.
Congratulations. And maybe at another time, you'll walk us through step by step how you did that so other people can emulate your incredible success. Well, you've been so generous with your time, Daniel. Before I let you go and before I just need to interrupt myself to say, everyone, this is the beautifully produced, I mean, apart from how completely valuable what's inside this book is, Unrig. It's one of the most beautifully produced books I've seen for quite a while, beautifully bound. I mean, it's really a work of art. And it would make an amazing gift. I mean, don't just buy this for you. Buy it for everyone on your list. You know, buy it as an early Christmas or Hanukkah or Kwanzaa gift. I mean, really, everyone you know needs this. And it spans all ages, and I would say all political backgrounds. You can give it to your 15-year-old in high school. You can give it to your 93-year-old parent. Everyone will get so much out of this book. And everyone in America really needs to read it. And I am not given to hyperbole, but this literally, there are two books. I've recently said this about yours and Greg Palast. I just spoke to him How Trump Stole 2020, those two books about how we protect the vote, how we protect democracy, I mean, those are the two most important books you can read this year, if not this decade. I mean, let's face it, we're in a fight for our democracy. We're in a fight for our lives, essentially. Everything we have been scared of, you and I, Daniel, and initially six other people, and now millions of other people, of you know, fascism in America or the end of democracy is coming true. And, you know, there are two ways to fight. One is blood in the streets. We don't want that. But we can avoid all of that by actually doing it the peaceful way, doing it the, you know, through grassroots politics and reclaiming our democracy for ourselves and for our children. So yeah, before I let you go, can you just tell us what drew you to this work? I mean, you work tirelessly. You've built beautiful things. You've cleaned up politics in your city. You've now brought your wisdom from MapLight and from decades of organizing and empowering people to unrig. What led you to this work, which, you know, is kind of thankless and difficult very often, right?
You know, Naomi, I'm an optimist, and I see things that sometimes other people don't see yet. And I wanted to bring forth in this book a clarity, because you read the headlines, it's really hard to tell, like, from reading all the news, like, what is actually going on and what is underneath the surface, so that the book seeks to do that. And also optimism, because I have met so many people over the last 20 years of doing this work who are just so inspiring, and they're actually bringing about change. And you don't read those stories in the newspaper, you don't read them in other books very much. And so with this book, like, clarity and optimism, it's like, that's what I'm all about, is really unpacking this stuff and showing people that the change is not only possible, but it's already happening.
Perfect words to end on. Daniel Newman, thank you so much for joining us here at Daily Clout. Everyone, the book is Unrig: How to Fix Our Broken Democracy. Daniel G. Newman and his talented illustrator, George O'Connor. It's absolutely gorgeous, and it's available everywhere you can buy books. Support your local independent if you possibly can, but get this book. Do not wait. And your website is?
Unrigbook.com.
There you go. And also check out MapLight, which is one of the most important things also you will have access to. So Daniel, thank you so much. Be safe. Take care. And everyone, this is Naomi Wolf and Daniel Newman, and the book is Unrig. Take care. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.